The number one thing that is in my earthquake kit is water.
So if I have like a six pack of LaCroix, is that enough for weathering the next big one?
Probably not.
Even if it's pubbles?
I can't even remember.
Welcome to Gimme Shelter, the California Housing Crisis Podcast. I'm Matt Levendetten, housing reporter with CalMatters.
And I'm Liam Dillon with the LA Times, bringing the energy today. Because, Matt, you sound a little lack of energy.
Oh, I do?
Yeah.
Well, I'm excited for this topic.
Me too.
Okay.
Great.
So today on the podcast, we'll be talking about the big one.
Earthquakes.
What happens to California's housing crisis when the inevitable happens, when a major earthquake hits a major population center?
So bad news becomes crisis year.
So we're obviously doing this in light of the Ridgecrest quake, a big earthquake, actually two big quakes, the first week of July. That was luckily pretty far from dense population areas. But we have a perfect guest to terrify you today.
This is Mayclare Bolton-Smith. She's a seismologist for the real estate data firm CoreLogic.
First seismologist on the podcast.
First of many, I'm sure.
Hopefully not.
Hopefully not. Yes.
Hopefully not. Where does seismologist rank on your like elementary school aspirational jobs? I feel like it was like, for California kids, yeah. Seismologists was like one or two. Okay. Marine biologists.
Okay.
I feel paleontologist. Like
paleontologist is at the top.
Yeah, I think paleontologist is number
one.
Yeah,
you see the fossils and the dinosaur bones and T-Rex, and you're like, I want to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's hard to be paleontologist.
It is.
But I think seismologist was a
strong
number two.
Yeah, particularly after the Rock movie.
So a couple notes about this podcast and probably some future podcasts too. Typically, we'll base a podcast off of our own reporting, whether it's on why renters don't have a lot of power in the Capitol or something Liam wrote about the flawed state housing law. But I think for some future podcasts, we'll venture a little bit out, things that neither Liam nor I have done extensive reporting on, but obviously could impact California's housing situation. So how do you feel about that?
This is a long way of saying we don't really know much about how earthquakes affect the housing situation, but we have a guest to tell us about that, and perhaps future episodes we'll be doing some similar things.
Yes, exploratory. Mm-hmm. Us learning, along with you, listener. Let's get to the most popular segment in all of California housing podcastery. It is
the avocado of the fortnight.
Our look at the most absurd housing story of the past 2 weeks, and the avocado this fortnight once again involves Kanye West.
Yeah, when I think absurd.
Oh, come on.
Well, he did have some classic albums.
Yes.
Yeah.
Misunderstood. True genius.
So, Matt, tell us, you know, I think we, on an early episode of the podcast, like the real true podcast heads will remember that Kanye was at one point an avocado of the fortnight. Tell us why he's back.
So in that previous avocado, the avocado was Kanye West wants to build affordable housing.
Yep.
Which, you know, very talented guy, does a lot of different things, designs shoes, leather jogging pants. We thought it somewhat odd that he wanted to get into the affordable housing space.
But hey.
But courtesy of a tweet from a podcast listener at Matt Sedlar, sorry for mispronouncing your last name, we now have more details as to what exactly will be entailed in Kanye's affordable housing development.
Yeah, so what are these places going to look like?
So this is from an amazing Forbes cover story from Zach O'Malley Greenberg, where he got to hang around. This is like my dream story. He got to hang around with Kanye and then drive to the prototypes of his affordable housing development. So
okay.
I shall read.
Yeah.
You like this sound effect
That's
here?
That's good, yeah. It's paper.
Just still waiting for that Radiolab call. Speaking of aliens, if you really want to see how West's creative process worked, then a visit to the Star Wars planet of Tatooine is necessary. Inspired by Luke Skywalker's childhood home, Wes has been working with a team to design prefabricated structures that sport the same austere aesthetic, with the goal of deploying them as low-income housing units. Just after midnight, see, this is where I get jealous.
Yeah.
Just after midnight, he ushers me into his Lamborghini for an impromptu visit, barreling back down the road with Bach blasting on the sound system. After about 15 minutes, we arrive at a bungalow in the woods.
I feel like this is like Kanye Mad Libs, you know? Lamborghini, Bach.
We stroll out into the chilly starless night, and I follow him up a dirt path deeper into the woods for several minutes until he stops at a clearing and looks up, wordless. There, with the hazy heft of something enormous and far away, stand a trio of structures that look like the skeletons of wooden spaceships. They're the physical prototypes of his concept, each oblong and dozens of feet tall, and Wes leads me inside each one. He tells me they could be used as living spaces for the homeless, perhaps sunk into the ground with light filtering in through the top. Do you remember what Luke's home looked like in A New Hope? It was not the most aesthetically pleasing.
All I remember about where Luke lived was that he lived inside the belly of one of those animals at one point.
Yeah, Tauntaun.
Yeah.
I think that's what they're called.
Okay.
Yeah.
You're going to get a lot of tweets from Star Wars people.
I'm sure there's considerable overlap, yes, too, in our fan base. He is not inside a Tauntaun. I don't think that's what Kanye is designing.
Oh, okay.
Yes. But they were
like
not...
The hut, like igloo, like...
Yeah, exactly. Shaped. It was like a desert igloo.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Which does not... I mean, I would not want to live there.
Yeah.
No, it looked.
Even if Kanye designed it?
Even if Kanye designed it. I mean, I applaud Kanye he could do a lot of different things with his time.
That's
good for him for going and putting money and effort into affordable housing, but I don't know how well this is going to work out.
Well, I mean, it certainly progressed much further from our previous avocado situation.
Yes, I did not see it being Star Wars themed.
Nor did I see actual prototypes being done. So, hey, you know. Maybe we'll put one of them in Venice and see what happens.
I can't wait until this gets like LIHTC funding.
Yeah,
that'd be pretty sweet. I want to see it get LIHTC funding. Okay. Anything else on this delicious avocado?
No.
Thank you, @MattSedlar. Before we get into how an earthquake will wreck everything in California, let's talk about the current state of some key housing bills in the Capitol. So we are recording this on Monday, July
15th. Yes.
Friday the 12th was the last day legislators spent in the Capitol before going on their summer vacation.
Mm-hmm.
Lawmakers get summer vacations.
Yes.
Kind of nice.
So we talk a lot about the calendar on this podcast because I think it is instructive to tell people where things are and kind of all these sorts of deadlines that are, I guess, manufactured, but very important. So there's nothing happening for a month. Lawmakers come back August 12th for their last month. And in that month, everything pretty much gets passed or fails. And so
it's a very hectic, busy time.
Indeed. So what happened over the past few weeks is there was bills had to get out of their final policy committees. And so longtime listeners of the podcast are familiar with the Appropriations Committee. That's the fiscal committee that most bills have to clear. That process still is to come in the month of August. And then it gets down to the floor where the bills get voted on by the full houses of the Senate and the Assembly. But before we get there, all through July or the beginning of July and June, discussions about bills making it through their sort of housing committee, judiciary committee, local government committee, all these sort of policy committees. And now we're at the point where we know kind of what's on the table for the last month.
So lots of things have obviously died before this point. Let's kind of focus in on two bills that remain that to me are the most high-profile bills. So let's start with AB 1482. This is a bill from Assemblyman David Chu, the rent cap bill. What's the latest with that?
Yeah, so this is legislation that barely cleared the Assembly floor. It would limit our annual rent increases to now 7% plus an inflationary measure. And that's roughly 10% we're talking.
Yeah.
And so this, among the measures that kind of got it off the Assembly floor was a guarantee that it would only last for 3 years. I guess that's the most narrowing part of it. A number of other carve-outs for kind of smaller landlords, mm-hmm. things like that. Since it passed Assembly floor in late May, there were a few things that were added.
Two big developments to me.
Yeah. So one is that, oftentimes, we've discussed this before, for these sorts of rent cap bills to have a significant effect, they have to be paired with a measure that restricts a landlord's ability to evict people or evict people for no cause.
Just cause eviction.
Yeah, because otherwise, if you want to evade the cap, you could very simply just evict someone and then raise the rents to whatever you want for the new tenant. So a bill that would have restricted these evictions did not make it out of the Assembly. And so what David Chu, the author of this bill, decided to do was to amend his bill to add those provisions back into his. And so now we have a bill that's sort of structurally sound in the sense that it does sort of both of the
policy-wise.
Policy-wise, right. Does kind of both the things that experts say you kind of need to do if you want to A, prevent evictions, and B, prevent sort of very high rent increases. So that's now happened, and that's the way the bill is structured now. Secondarily, part of the reason why, or kind of the primary reason why, there are a number of these kind of narrowing boring changes that happened to the bill as it worked its way off the assembly was there was a kind of a neutrality agreement with the California Association of Realtors, mm-hmm. a real power player on housing politics at the Capitol, where they said, oh, okay, you want to limit this to 3 years, a number of other things, we will agree not to oppose your bill. And so that's kind of the last thing that happened that got the bill off the assembly floor. But now the realtors have told legislators that they, in fact, are still opposed to this legislation, the negotiation or the agreement. They're not satisfied with the actual language that's in the bill.
Cumulatively.
Yes.
The realtors' newfound opposition, which could somehow possibly be mollified in some way.
Yeah.
And then the re-inclusion of just cause into the bill makes this a much tougher political fight going forward. So it will have to clear the Senate floor, which will be a very difficult test.
Well, it has to clear the Appropriations Committee first.
Yeah, that's true. It has to, yes. So it could very well die there.
Yeah.
Head of the Appropriations Committee, Senator Anthony Portantino, who people now who listen to this podcast know on a almost a first-name basis,
right.
For burying SB 50.
Yeah.
So if it gets through that, and then even if it gets through the Senate floor, it'll have to go back to the Assembly where just cause eviction could not get a floor vote, right?
Exactly.
So that exact same bill, almost exact same bill, now included in Choose bill, would have to be approved by that same body that didn't approve it last month.
That's right.
Yeah.
And remember also, there's a specter of, you know, I was out this past weekend, a number of events, including the California State Fair in Sacramento, and I saw people tabling for getting signatures to collect for the 2020 rent control initiative, sponsored again by the AIDS Healthcare Foundation out of LA. And so that obviously adds a specter of leverage or negotiation or a clear signal this is not done. No matter if AB 1402 were to pass, Michael Weinstein, the head of the AIDS Healthcare Foundation, is an opponent of AB 1402, says it's not strong enough. So that the rent control is not going away if the measure were to pass or if it, or even if it fails.
And again, this is all keeping with the theme of how difficult it is to pass pro-tenant legislation in the Capitol. I mean, now that we've kind of seen something get through this far and how much it's been watered down, it's I don't know. It's pretty eye-opening.
Yeah. Speaking of watered down,
That's like your favorite go-to segue.
Right.
Yeah. Let's talk about probably the most high-profile bill when it comes to limiting what local governments can do to restrict new housing being built. Let's talk about SB 330, a bill from Senator Nancy Skinner from Berkeley. Where does that stand?
Yeah, so a number of other amendments that have been made to this provision for it to get off the Senate floor. It was narrowed from taking effect for 10 years, and now it's 5 years. And this is, again, as Matt said, a measure that would limit local government's ability to sort of add new restrictions or enforce some existing ones when it comes to approving housing development. So a couple other things have been kicked out of this bill since it's worked its way through the Senate process. I'm sorry, through the Assembly process. One is it used to have a very strict rules against local governments allowing or requiring parking minimums. That is now gone. So that's no longer part of the bill. Also, it would have attacked measures like one that exists in the city of Encinitas, a northern San Diego coastal city, which has never had a state-approved housing plan.
Mm-hmm.
One reason for that, in recent years, the city has a voter-approved a mandate that says anytime density is increased in its city, that has to go back to the voters for approval. And so that's one of the main reasons currently that the city does not have a state approved housing plan, because they will not increase density to the levels that are mandated. And so originally SB 330 would have nullified that during the time period it was in effect. And now that provision is gone from the bill as well.
So just to kind of break that down in concrete terms, in Encinitas, if there's a patch of land zoned for, I'm going to simplify this incredibly, but let's say you can only build up to 4 stories.
Right.
If the developer comes along and the planning department for Encinitas comes along and say, okay, we want to raise this to 6 stories, that requires a vote from the entire city of Encinitas.
Yes. Not just that, not even for a particular project. If they just want to increase, you know, absent a particular project, increase that from 4 stories to 6 stories or all those sorts of things, that too requires a vote.
And so the original version, SB 330, would say, no, Encinitas, you can't require this to go to a public vote.
Yep.
That's gone.
Yep.
Any other big takeaways from remaining legislation in the Capitol. Next month's going to be busy.
Yeah, but just that we see that this is kind of the way the process works, and we've talked about this a lot. I mean, we have seen, you know, 2 years ago, and in terms of other topic areas, when there's a sort of agreement to move kind of high-profile legislation or high-profile package of legislation, you know, that's when this whittling process gets taken out of the equation, right? But left to everybody's own devices, kind of every policy committee takes the chunk out of a bill that they don't particularly appreciate, and so that's kind of what's been happening with all this housing legislation.
So I know this is an impossible question, but are these bills more diluted or less diluted than you would have thought at this point?
Well, I think where they are now is what would have been expected if there were not leadership or the governor involved in maintaining a certain structure to these bills.
I tend to agree with that.
Yeah.
Speaking of housing packages, there have been whispers and public comments about a special session devoted to housing. I have no real feel as to how realistic that is. And by special session, all that means is Governor Newsom says, okay, guys, we're going to devote this month or whatever time period to passing housing legislation. This is special. We have to do this month when you're not ordinarily here.
Yeah, they could come back in the fall.
Yeah.
Whereas they're not, would otherwise not normally be here to do it. Yeah.
I don't have a really strong feeling as to whether that's going to happen or not. I haven't really talked to a ton of people about that specifically. Do you have a read on that?
No. I mean, yeah. I think it's been whispered about. I think Senator Jim Bell from San Jose voted that.
Publicly.
Perhaps a few other lawmakers. But yeah, I mean, you know, I think, you know, kind of what started it. And I'll give this preview to listeners. I'm working on a piece about the state of Oregon, which passed a stricter rent cap, or at least a rent cap that's kind of perpetual, wouldn't be limited to 3 years,
mm-hmm.
and also recently passed legislation that ends in much of the state single-family-only zoning, allowing for duplexes and up to fourplexes in many places. And so, you know, Oregon got big things done this year, and it doesn't look like California is.
Mm-hmm.
And so if California wants to, then really the special session seems to be the only way to go.
Yeah, I think also the further along these marquee bills move along in the process, my gut is the less likely we would see a special legislative session, right? If you thought you were going to have a special session, you would hold back on moving things like the rent cap or like SB 330, right?
Because they'd be part of whatever sort of larger deal that you may want to make.
And potentially they could be stronger.
Yep.
Okay. Let's talk about this. I'm excited to talk about this.
Yeah.
Let's talk about earthquakes, man.
Okay.
What happened on July 4th?
So there was a pretty big earthquake.
Yeah.
6.4 in the Ridgecrest area in Kern County. That's a city of about 29,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
Roughly 100 miles, LA is roughly 100 miles south of the epicenter of this. And there was an earthquake, damage to homes, no deaths, very fortunately.
Yes.
And then 2 days later, an even bigger earthquake in the same place, a 7.1.
Really big.
Yeah, that really got people thinking and worried about, the kind of damage that earthquakes could do.
Yes, and not to pick on Ridgecrest in any way, but if you had to pick a place in California for a 7.1 earthquake to happen, you would opt for
somewhere out in the Mojave Desert.
Exactly, exactly. So California has been relatively lucky in that regard that we have not had a major earthquake hit a major population center since 1994, really, the Northridge quake. Liam, why don't you tell us about your highly limited earthquake experience, and then I'll just completely overshadow it with mine. Go ahead.
I'll give you two.
Is that necessary?
Yeah, I'll be quick.
Okay.
1989, I was watching the World Series, and I was like, wow, that's...
From Philadelphia?
From Philadelphia.
Okay.
I was watching the World Series.
Yeah, you're like, that seems bad.
That seems bad. You know, I saw the bridge and everything. Ugh, eee. That's my 1989 earthquake experience.
Mm-hmm.
In 2010, I was living in San Diego, and there was a large earthquake in Imperial County that was felt. I remember sitting in my apartment on a couch and just being like, huh. And then, like, the cupboard was shaking and the dishes were shaking in there. I was like, huh, this must be an earthquake. And it was long, maybe 30 seconds to a minute. And it was like, oh,
yeah,
okay. And that was it.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
But it was a real thing.
So I lived in Sherman Oaks in L.A. in 1994, which is, I think, less than 50 miles away from Northridge, the epicenter of the quake.
Uh-huh.
It's a very strong memory. I remember my golden retriever, Casey. This must have been at like 4 in the morning.
Yeah.
Freaking out. She never barked. She was barking. Mm-hmm. So that woke me up.
Yeah.
And then everything starts shaking. My dad rushes into the bedroom and like physically picks me up. I'm like nine or 10 at this point. Uh-huh. And we go into the living room, bunch of broken glass, completely pitch black. We turn on the radio, right, to listen to what's happening. Yeah. And they say it's a big earthquake, and they don't have the actual magnitude yet. But it ends up being a 6.4. And our house got pretty badly damaged. The foundation was fine, but we had, like, broken windows, just endless, like, there was more shattered glass than I think there was glass in the house. Yeah. I don't know exactly how that happens.
Yeah.
Eventually, once it got a little brighter, everybody coming out into the street and looking at each other's houses. And I remember I had friends in elementary school whose parents were originally from the East Coast. This was their first earthquake.
Yeah.
And some of them just left afterwards.
Wow.
They were just like, no, I'm not dealing with this.
Huh.
I remember I had one friend who lived in a multifamily apartment complex that eventually was condemned. He ended up going back to the East Coast and then eventually to Israel. That was my firmly ingrained 94 earthquake memory.
That's firmly ingrained.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because, like, you know, I imagine your, you know, your house, given there's no structural damage, sort of seen as kind of the, one of the lucky situations.
Yes.
But still, it's
there were houses like, down the block that were not as fortunate.
So, but still, it sounds like a lot of repair, a lot of having to clean up. And, you know, I think there's something to keep in mind as we talk about this is, like, we think oftentimes think in terms of, like, destruction and, like, total uninhabitability. But even minor damage, relatively minor damage, it's a huge effort, you know, to kind of clean it up and to fix it.
Exactly.
But, yeah.
So, this is a 800-pound gorilla in the California housing landscape that nobody talks about enough, right?
Yeah.
Like, we've talked about wildfires more recently and how that could impact our housing crunch because it happens every year.
Yeah.
The wildfire analogy, I think, is a valuable one because if you look at what happened with Paradise, if you look at what happened with Santa Rosa, and the one, the magnitude of destruction, and then two, the impacts on the local housing market, right?
Yeah.
The housing crunch that we see currently in Chico, right? And then in areas around Santa Rosa. Those are relatively small communities.
Yeah.
All in all, at least compared to
LA.
Oakland, exactly.
Right. Yeah.
Exactly. Uh-huh. Liam, why don't you talk about the haywired scenario and how terrifying that is?
Yeah, it's just a report that was done, the U.S. Geological Survey, with a number of other seismologists around, kind of modeling what could happen if the this major fault. Under Hayward and a number of cities in the East Bay, communities in the East Bay, in the Bay Area, where there was a 7.0 earthquake. And, you know, there's one on this fault line every 150 years, and the last one was 1868, so...
We're due.
Due, yeah. And so, you know, this... You know, and again, this is not like the famous San Andreas fault, right? This is another fault. That people don't think about or talk about as much. But a major earthquake here would threaten 2 million buildings, according to this report, in the Bay Area. And all sorts of problems, up to 400,000 people displaced, 800 deaths, 18,000 injuries.
22,000 people stuck in an elevator.
Yeah.
So this scenario there, it is doomsday in the sense of not the magnitude of the quake, but when it happened. So they're saying this is basically a weekday at 4 o'clock.
Right.
Thus, I think 22,000 people stuck in an elevator.
Yeah. Oof.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And goes into all sorts of other problems that could come as a result of the earthquake, resulting in potential fires and things like that. And we get into a lot of this with our guest, but it really goes to show, I think, the amount of devastation and quick devastation that you could have in scenarios like this with really out any real warning to do anything about it.
That's right. Yeah. And that 400,000 figure, what do you do with those people?
Right.
I mean, so that includes some people who are temporarily unable to get back into their house, right, or their apartment complex. So eventually they will be. But where do you house them? I don't know.
There's no answer. I mean,
no.
You could house 400,000. I mean, tomorrow, if there was homes enough for people, there would be 400,000 people who would move to California.
Exactly.
Or pay way cheaper rent than they do now to live in California and sort of a better situation. And so you just add another, you know, I mean, you know, we saw, you know, as you referenced to Santa Rosa and Paradise, small numbers of folks, right, in the thousands or even tens of thousands, right? Their impact on the housing costs and the housing market and where they could go and people still displaced from both of those situations. And you know, this obviously order of magnitude higher number of people, order of magnitude worse in terms of housing effect.
So I was reading a little bit about what happened in the wake of the 89 earthquake in San Francisco, and one of the most vulnerable structures were a single room occupancy buildings, so which, you know, were primarily housing low-income San Franciscans. A bunch of those were uninhabitable after the quake. And it was interesting. I didn't know any of this, but it became a major political problem for the mayor of San Francisco at the time, because it immediately increased the city's homeless population.
Sure.
And some of those who were made homeless by the earthquake ended up camping right outside City Hall, and it became this enduring symbol of the city not being able to recover.
Exactly.
So you can easily imagine, considering the way things are now in the Bay Area, right, how exponentially worse housing prices are and how much worse the homelessness crisis is throughout the Bay, what might happen. So I don't know, just reading through all of this, like, there's all these efforts to ease the housing crunch and ease the housing crisis in California, and then on one particularly bad day, it all goes to hell.
Yeah. Well, it's the same with the wildfires. It's the same with, you know, I mean, you have to kind of built in slack in the system, right? To deal with all potential and almost certainly eventualities of these sorts of situations, whether they are greater chances of wildfires, which we're certainly seeing, or things like earthquakes.
Well, another thing that jumped out to me is I did not know if your building is up to code in terms of earthquakes. That only means that it will protect you. It might not survive the earthquake. So up to code means it won't fall on top of your head. You'll be able to get out of your building, but it doesn't mean that you're guaranteed.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That you're able to come back in. Anyway, I highly recommend the Haywired Report as a pre-bedtime reading. Mm-hmm. You read it to your kids right before they go to bed. It is absolutely terrifying. Similar to that New Yorker story.
On the Seattle, right?
Yeah. It's eye-opening. All right. Anything else on earthquakes and California's housing stock?
No, let's talk to Mae Claire.
We're here with Mae Claire Bolton-Smith, who's a seismologist for the real estate data firm CoreLogic. Thanks for joining us, Mae Claire.
Thanks so much for having me.
Liam and I are both in our mid-30s. What is the likelihood that we will see a major earthquake in a major population center in our lifetimes?
I would say pretty good.
I
know. It's something that people often worry about, but the U.S. Geological Survey and the Uniform California Earthquake Rupture Forecast have done a lot of looking into the probability of earthquakes happening, and there's a pretty high probability of a damaging earthquake happening somewhere in California in our lifetime. So I'm kind of in that same age range as you, and I know that it'll happen, but we just don't know when it'll happen or where it would happen.
That sounds really scary.
Yeah, it has the potential to be scary, but I always say, everybody's always like, you know, what can we do to get prepared for earthquakes? And honestly, I truly believe the number one thing people can do to be prepared for an earthquake is to believe it will happen. Because if you just live in a world that you're like, nope, not going to happen here, not going to happen to me, then when it does happen, you're taken so off guard and you're really scared and you're not prepared at all. But even just believing something, it'll just help you become more resilient. And then the next step is to become prepared, learn about your risk, get an earthquake kit, have your home evaluated. Maybe it needs to be retrofitted. Maybe get earthquake insurance. Like, there's a lot of things we can do to prepare for earthquakes. But if you don't believe it's going to happen, then there's no hope for you.
So there's no movie featuring The Rock about the fault line at Hayward. but it sounds like this is like a big deal, this fault line, not, you know, obviously the one that captures all of our attention to San Andreas, right? But talk to us about the Hayward fault line, what cities run under it, and how worried we should be about it.
Yeah, it's interesting because you're right. Everybody thinks California, they think the San Andreas Fault, and they don't really give light to a lot of other events. And so Hayward is interesting. The Hayward Fault runs through the San Francisco East Bay. I've heard some stories or reports call it America's most dangerous fault because it does run through big cities. Has the potential to impact, so it's not through San Francisco, but it will definitely impact San Francisco, runs through Oakland, Hayward, Fremont, down towards San Jose. So the impact on the Silicon Valley also is really a big deal from an event like this. So it's also of interest because the last big earthquake was a magnitude 6.8 earthquake, and it happened in 1868. Uh-huh. And scientists believe that there is about, when they look at the history of events there, it's about a 150-year return period. So that means about every 150 years, they can expect to see an earthquake of that size happen on that fault. And 1868 was 150 and a half years ago. So we're definitely in the time frame for expecting a big earthquake on the Hayward Fault.
How prepared are we for that earthquake?
Well, it's a good question because earthquakes, people think of California, they know we have earthquakes here, but I think people get really complacent and the average person may not believe an earthquake will happen or may not be prepared for it. But the state and the government and a lot of different agencies have done a lot to really prepare for earthquakes. So building codes, for example, there's two earthquakes in the late 80s, early 90s in California, the Loma Prieta earthquake that struck south of San Francisco. It was in the Santa Cruz region in 1989. It was a magnitude 6.9 earthquake. And then 5 years later in 1994 was the Northridge earthquake that everyone in Los Angeles remembers from 1994, magnitude 6.7 earthquake. Those two earthquakes taught us a lot about how buildings respond to earthquakes. So building codes changed dramatically after the Northridge earthquake. So in terms of how our buildings are built today, they're built pretty strong to withstand earthquakes and to keep people safe. So one thing that people don't necessarily understand about building codes is a building code is not a no damage code. So if you say, oh, my building is built to the right building code, uh-huh, there's not going to be any damage. That's not true. Building codes are designed for life safety. So they're designed to keep people alive. So there may be a lot of damage to your home or to your office, but that building is going to stay standing so that you can stay alive inside of it.
But you may not necessarily be able to go back in and re-inhabit it anytime soon.
Exactly, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that also takes it, what about the, you know, a lot of the apartment stock in San Francisco in particular is significantly older than in the early to mid-90s. What about those buildings?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. There's a number of older buildings. Building codes are for new buildings built from that moment on, so they don't do anything. A lot of the older buildings have been retrofitted, so that's important. You can definitely, retrofitting is just strengthening the building to bring it up to a stronger level so that it will withstand earthquakes. Again, things that were learned in both Loma Prieta and Northridge about how to secure buildings, bolting them to the foundation. Something that's common in the Bay Area is to have a cripple wall, which is like kind of a half story below the main story, and just bracing that so it's just a little like a crawl space under the house, just having that braced so that it gives it a little bit more structural integrity. So there's a lot of things we have learned for even those older buildings that can help them still stay standing to be safe during an earthquake, but not all buildings have gone through that.
So you were involved with this USGS report that tries to predict kind of the real-world consequences of a 7.0 magnitude earthquake on that Hayward fault line that you terrified us with earlier. So how much of the housing stock is really vulnerable in that region to that big of an earthquake?
So the first thing I'll correct you there is we never try to use the word predict when we're looking at earthquakes, because earthquakes or even earthquake damage is prediction is something that isn't really possible.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more like forecasting what the impact would be. And what we're seeing with the Hayward event, so Hayward was a scenario on the Hayward Fault earthquake, looking at a magnitude 7 earthquake followed by 16 aftershocks of magnitude 5 or greater. And this was led by the USGS and a coalition of a bunch of other multidisciplinary collaborators, and we were grateful to be a part of this. And we looked at and saw that there's a number of the homes across the Bay Area are impacted by this event, and that the total damage from an event like this could be upwards of $170 billion. When we look at the number of homes impacted, our analysis estimates that almost 1 million homes would be damaged in this event. So when we look at the Bay Area, which has a population of about 7 million people, that's a large number of the homes that we have here in the Bay Area, and those would be damaged, not all fully lost, but damaged from this event. And then the next thing that you bring up is really important, too, is that the infrastructure would also be damaged. So people may not have power, they may not have gas, there may not be access to clean water. So that then really comes into the personal preparedness side of things and being prepared for an earthquake and having things on hand, like a lot of water on hand for people in your house and your pets to be able to drink and use for a number of days until you may be able to get those resources back.
So also in that report, along with that 1 million home figure you cited, there was a forecast that as many as 400,000 people might be at least temporarily displaced. Does the local government or regional government or state government, is there a plan for what to do with that many displaced households?
Yeah, that's a really important question, and I can't speak to exactly what the local governments are doing. I know that a lot of work is being done at all levels of government for planning on what would happen. If you look at past earthquakes that have happened, the Loma Prieta earthquake, which happened in October of 1989, I remember there's some pretty famous pictures of people living in tents out in parks after that event happened because they couldn't live in their homes. We've seen from hurricanes and flooding events that or wildfires that people do go to evacuation centers and have a place to live. But with that scale of people, it's going to be very difficult to house those people. One thing that the California Earthquake Authority, which is a great entity that helps offer earthquake insurance, they have something that is in their earthquake insurance policies that's for additional living expenses. And it's really one of the most powerful things that if you're not able to inhabit your home, to be able to get money from insurance to live somewhere else while your home is being fixed so that you would be able to live somewhere. But aside from having that, and not a lot of people have earthquake insurance, like the number is about 15%, I think maybe even 13%. It's fairly low for the number of people that actually have earthquake insurance. So it's a daunting number when you think of the number of people that may be without a place to live after an event like this.
Can you speak to, we talked some of about the kind of downstream effects on infrastructure, but it's not just the earthquake that could create damage. There's also fears of things like fires that could also lead to displacing folks. Can you talk about how an earthquake could then lead to other kind of disasters or other effects that would also impact people's ability to live in the community?
Yeah, so earthquakes are really just the first step in many ways. It's the ground shaking, but that ground shaking, which causes damage, can damage different things, utilities. And fires are very common to break out after earthquakes. One of the most common things for fire ignitions is gas mains will break and they will ignite fires. And with the right conditions or the wrong conditions, I guess maybe, a fire could spread. So if there's no wind that day, a fire may break out and that would be fine. But we've seen some devastating wildfires in the last couple of years, and those wildfires that have happened is because the conditions have just been optimal and the wind just picked up and started blowing the fire. So if by chance it was a very windy day and a fire did break out, there's a potential for widespread fire. In 1906, the San Francisco earthquake, that's one of the most famous things, is that there was this enormous earthquake that happened along the San Andreas Fault, devastated the city of San Francisco, but really the bulk of the damage from that event was the fire destroyed the city. And one of the big things that happened there was the earthquake severed three of the four water mains that served the city. So there was no water to fight the fires, to put out the fires in San Francisco back in the time. So that's part of what contributed to the city being so damaged. So San Francisco itself, this is actually really fascinating. They're one of the few cities around the world. Vancouver is another one where I'm very familiar with as well, that have done something that's pumping in seawater to help fight fires. So if you walk around the city of San Francisco, there's two different kinds of fire hydrants you'll see. There's the normal little fire hydrants, and then there's these fire hydrants that are about three times the size of a normal fire hydrant. And those are pumping in seawater from the bay and from the ocean to fight fires. So those are specifically designed for earthquake firefighting after disasters. So even though something may happen, there's some measures that have been put in place in certain cities to definitely try and mitigate some of the impact from that.
So does the East Bay have that? And does Los Angeles have that?
I'm not sure about Los Angeles, to tell you the truth. And in the Bay Area, San Francisco is the only city that does have that I'm aware of. But it's definitely something that's been done in San Francisco. So
recently, as you probably know, some California cities have experienced really bad wildfires. Santa Rosa in the North Bay, obviously Paradise in the Northern Central Valley. And what we saw as a result of the fires was an exacerbated housing crunch, right? We saw rents rise in neighboring cities because you had a big population that didn't have housing anymore. Is there any reason to think that an earthquake in a major population center would result in anything different?
Yeah, I think the wildfires have really given us something to go by when really understanding what the impact on communities can be after disasters. So I haven't personally done any research on this or any studies myself, but I think what we've seen can be expected to happen after earthquakes. It's probably inevitable. The one thing, though, is in the city itself that is damaged, if a large percentage of the homes are damaged, we may not see housing prices increase if the homes are damaged, but the need for rental properties may increase because of the supply and demand, just given the fact that there'll be a lot of people needing places to live. And if there isn't a lot of them, the supply and demand could go up.
Fire insurance allowed a lot of those communities to rebuild. But but at least from the analysis that you guys did, it seems like earthquake insurance isn't going to allow a lot of residents to rebuild in the way that we saw in kind of fire-stricken places.
That's a really important difference between fires and earthquakes, is that everyone who has a home insurance policy has a fire policy, but earthquake is a separate endorsement, so you need special earthquake insurance, and not a lot of people have it. So that really is the controlling factor there, is if everyone had earthquake insurance the way they had fire insurance, we would see that power to be able to rebuild. But because it is an optional insurance, that unless you have it, you won't get that insurance payout for any damage that does happen.
So there's been a lot of debate, and I think it's more theoretical or philosophical at this point than actually practical, because there's been no sort of formal proposals to do this. But a lot of questions about whether we should be rebuilding or building at all in some of these areas in the state that are at a high risk of wildfire. Do you think that we should be building, continue to build in areas that are at high risk of earthquake damage?
I know that's a question that comes up a lot, and it's because the earthquake-prone areas are some of the most beautiful places in the country and the world. Many of them are coastal regions. They're the most desired places for people to want to live. So it's pretty hard to not build where earthquakes can happen because they're so beautiful. But there is, and earthquakes are not like fires or not like floods. They don't happen every year. So it kind of puts in that complacency of like, oh, well, it will be okay, and we'll build strong enough, and it will be okay. But that really comes down to land use planning and, you know, what's the best land to be able to use for building homes and cities and communities on. But I don't think we'll ever see people not build in these beautiful coastal regions like Los Angeles and the San Francisco Bay Area. But you do bring up a great question of is it the best place for us to be building. And I mean, I'm a seismologist and I moved here by choice, and it was because it's a beautiful place to be and I'm kind of in the center of the action when something happens, but I'm also crazy. I do realize that I know that I'm living in a place that an earthquake will happen. My husband and I just bought a home last year, and I'm like, ugh. Here we go. But I was also very much like I wanted a single-story house. I wanted something that was as safe as it could possibly be. I say single-story because there's a lot of damage in the Loma Prieta earthquake in 1989 with homes that had a garage on the bottom of them. And it's simply that's something called a soft story structure, and it's simply that you have this rigid structure over the very open ground floor. So those homes were seen to be quite damaged. So when we were buying our house, I'm like, I'm not buying that house. I'm not like, I'm paying a lot of money for this house.
Yeah.
We are getting something that we know is a good investment, and we're not spending our money in a way that it's just going to completely be devastated.
So home buying tip is just no garage.
No garage underneath the house is a big one.
Okay.
So
yeah.
You can have a garage, but just not underneath the house.
Also, to your point, Liam, where else are we going to live? You can't live near the coast because there's an earthquake.
Yeah. Right.
You can't live in the, what's it called, the urban...
The wild urban... Ooh,
interface.
Wild urban interface.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's like Bakersfield. No, there's still earthquakes in Bakersfield. It's like Sacramento and San Diego. That's it.
Earthquakes in San Diego, too.
Oh, there's earthquakes in San Diego.
Yeah.
Don't you think there's not? Yeah.
Oh, okay. I thought they were smaller, typically, than...
Well, the San Andreas. So if we want to talk about our good old friend, the San Andreas, it's infamous, right? It's the one thing... It's probably the number one fault in the world that people think of when they think of earthquakes. Like, yes, you think of Japan, you think of Indonesia, you think of New Zealand, like, but can people name those faults? I can, but the average person, if you ask them what's the most famous fault in the world, chances are that person's going to say the San Andreas.
Yeah.
So,
made a whole movie, as we said, discussed. Yes, right.
So the thing about the San Andreas that is really interesting is it runs almost the entire state of California. It starts up in Humboldt County, up in the north, which is about 100 miles from the Oregon border, and it goes down just about to the Mexican border. So it doesn't go through It doesn't go through Los Angeles or San Diego, but it goes very close to them. It does run right through San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very dangerous fault. And the thing that's fascinating about the San Andreas is science has come so far, and that we've got a lot of knowledge about past earthquakes that have happened over the last several years, like millennia. We can tell from they call it paleoseismic activity, so like looking in the dirt to see the record to see when earthquakes have happened. And they can see kind of how frequent earthquakes have happened. But it's always thought that the northern San Andreas and the southern San Andreas were not connected. And there's this little area in the middle that they call creeping, that it kind of just, they just thought that you couldn't get an earthquake that would propagate through from north to south. And some research that came out a couple of years ago showed that there's now a belief that it can actually go, and northern and southern California could be impacted in the same earthquake at the same time. So that's crazy, because from an emergency preparedness perspective, like, I know that there's a lot of planning between northern and southern California that they're like, well, we're not going to get an earthquake at the same time. So if an earthquake happens in Los Angeles, we'll pull resources from northern California, or vice versa. If something happens up in the north, we'll pull it from southern California. But now we're looking at the impact of what if this earthquake did happen and the entire fault was impacted, or the entire fault ruptured and the entire state essentially was impacted. And I know you like to know what's the impact on homes. And we actually did a study specifically looking at that, like what is the impact on single-family residential homes from that event happening. So it's looking at a magnitude 8.3 earthquake.
Oh, my God.
Which is the entire length of the fault. And it looks like there's about 3.5 million homes that are impacted from, not just impacted, but I think we
What an amazingly appropriate number. That's the same number of homes that Gavin Newsom says he wants to build to solve the state's housing shortage. Yeah, 3.5 million.
So definitely, I mean, that's a big number.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of homes that would be impacted. It's a lot of people that would be impacted. So, I mean, I don't want to take away from the haywired scenario, because it's really important for the East Bay or for the San Francisco Bay region. But if we look a little broader at, like, what could happen across California, like, that's scary. That's really scary to think.
The last thing I want to have you do is just drill in on the types of residential structures that are most vulnerable.
Yeah, it's a good question, and it's one a lot of people probably don't necessarily think of. My husband laughs at me all the time because we walk by a building and I'm like, nope, not going in there. But just occupational hazard. And I'm not even an earthquake engineer. I'm a seismologist. So I have a bit of the engineering perspective just because I hang out with a lot of earthquake engineers. But really, the key thing here in California, as I mentioned, the building code changed in 1996. And that was really with the lessons learned from the Northridge earthquake. So anything built since 1996 is definitely a stronger building. So that's a positive. So when looking for something, that's important. A couple of structural things that make a building more vulnerable are a garage underneath a home that makes it a soft story structure. So that makes it weaker on the ground floor. So when the building is shaking, it's not going to have anything to really be secure holding it together on the bottom. Anything that's not bolted to the foundation, that it can just slip right off the foundation. So one of the most common retrofitting things is to bolt the house to the foundation. One of the types of buildings I like the least are the apartment buildings that have what's called tuck under parking. So the front of the building will look like a 3 or 4 story apartment building, but the back will only be 3 stories, but the bottom layer is completely gone and there's little popsicle sticks.
I used to live in one of those. Yeah.
And it's a really vulnerable type of structure. And they are reinforced steel, hopefully, that are holding them up. I call them popsicle sticks because they don't look very secure. So you do hope they are secure, but still, that is, you're lessening the structural integrity of the building by raising up and completely taking away one layer of it and putting little posts to hold it up.
All right. That's it for me, Liam. You got any other questions that will terrify us?
Anything else? I was just about to say, anything else that you think our listeners should know or you want to leave them with?
Well, this might be scary. I don't want to scare everybody, but I think just because a lot of your listeners are down in Los Angeles, I guess the one thing is a lot of people think that the San Andreas Fault is the big fault for Los Angeles, and that's not the case at all. And I think one thing that the Ridgecrest earthquake that occurred on the 4th and 5th of July really showed people was that earthquakes occur on faults that are not the San Andreas Fault. And fortunately for those in Southern California, that earthquake was in a fairly remote area of the Mojave Desert, and yes, there was damage in the communities local to it, but there's a lot of faults that can produce an earthquake of that size much closer to the city of Los Angeles, and I don't think people are necessarily aware of that. So there's a number of faults in the L.A. Basin. One of the most scary to me is called the Puente Hills Fault, and if that were to rupture in an earthquake right underneath downtown Los Angeles, that would be a really bad day. Like, it could be a very devastating earthquake. And some of the numbers that I've shared for like the full length of the San Andreas Fault or the Hayward Fault, what we would see if something being impacted in downtown Los Angeles like that, those numbers would be probably a lot higher just because of the number of people and the number of homes in Los Angeles. So knowledge is power. So at least be aware of the fact that it's not just one earthquake on the San Andreas Fault that the Rock is not going to come and save you from. That,
oh, no.
I was counting on him. He was in my earthquake kit.
Me too. Yeah. There was like an inflatable rock.
Sorry, guys. No, not going to happen.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Mae Claire.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great to chat with you both.
Thank you for listening to Gimme Shelter, the California Housing Crisis Podcast. This is Matt Levin, Data and Housing Reporter with CalMatters. You can find me on Twitter at MLevinReports.
And I'm Liam Dillon with the LA Times. My Twitter handle is @DillonLiam.
Keep on rating and reviewing the podcast, and we'll be back in 2 weeks.